Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Coming soon to Dread, The Maid. Joy is the new maid of a royal house, whose previous maid disappeared under mysterious circumstances and is now haunting and terrorizing the family. Joy works to uncover the reason behind the former maid's disappearance. The Maid will be made available on demand everywhere July 20, 2021, and on Blu-ray August 17th, 2021. Welcome to Development Hell. Available now from Dread, the Queen of Spades. According to legend, an ominous entity known as the Queen of Spades can be summoned by performing an ancient ritual. Four teenagers summon the Queen of Spades, but they could never imagine the horrors that await them. The Queen of Spades is available on demand everywhere and on Blu-ray, July 3rd, 2021. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. So today we have a very special guest. We have Peaches Christ with us to talk about Trick or Treat 2, which is incredible. So Peaches, would you do us a favor and introduce yourself to the Development Hell audience?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I'm Peaches Christ, and I live in San Francisco, California. I am a drag queen entertainer who's really built a sort of a show business career based around my love for cult movies. So mm-hmm. I screen cult movies. I create parody shows of cult movies. I'm also a filmmaker who makes movies mm-hmm. that may or may not become cult movies. And I now have a podcast about cult movies called Midnight Mass.
So amazing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Midnight Mass?
Sure. So Midnight Mass originally was my midnight movie stage show that I did here in San Francisco for many, many years, which evolved into a show that was no longer at midnight because I got old and I started making bigger productions. So in the early days, the pre-show before the movie screening was short and sweet, and it happened at midnight, and it was usually sketch comedy and maybe a contest or two. And over the years, we got more and more ambitious, and the pre-shows got longer and longer and longer, and then people were coming for the shows rather than the screenings. And so we moved to the Castro Theater. We basically graduated from a 400-seat movie theater called The Bridge to a 1,400-seat movie theater called The Castro, and it was no longer called Midnight Mass because it wasn't happening at midnight anymore. So recently, I have dug up the old title and created a podcast with my friend collaborator Michael Verratti, who's also a filmmaker, film writer, and we are doing this podcast and centering it around our love for cult movies, and specifically really looking at the cult behind these movies. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we'll be talking about the movies, but we're really talking about the way in which these movies changed people's lives. So talking to a lot of obsessed fans.
Oh, I love obsessed fans.
Yeah.
I did an episode last week on a video game called Silent Hills that never happened. Oh. And I just was not aware of the ferociousness of that community. And now I know. So yeah, they hold things very close to their heart. And I respect that because I like Tori Amos so much, I could die. So I get it on some level.
So Tori Amos is like, if you were to worship at the altar of any icon, you think at the top of the list, it would be Tori Amos.
Yes.
I love that.
Gosh, oh, thank you.
So how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 32.
Wow. You're very young to love Tori Amos.
I'm one of the young ones. It's true.
I was going to say, I assume maybe you were more like my age, but wow, I'm impressed.
I missed the heyday when I got involved. She was real downhill. And you know what? I celebrate that. I truly do.
I don't know if your icon would love to hear that.
Oh, she wouldn't. But she's not listening. Yeah. Well, I buy each album. I go to each tour. What else do you want from me, Tori? What do you want?
And, I feel like she's one of those artists who, this is how old I am. I had, her first album on cassette tape.
Jealous.
Drive around when I was 16 years old and play
just,
it in a
just
car.
Just crying. Just crying.
Yes, just crying and loving it. I mean, God. Her lyrics, I mean, I'm Peaches Christ. She wanted to smash the faces of those beautiful boys.
Yeah, I bet you she did.
Anyway, whatever. I love that you love her.
Oh, I'm obsessed with her. Yeah.
Yeah, we are on Midnight Mass. We are limiting it for now to film icons.
Mm.
But, if we ever do a version on, I don't know, what would you call her? I mean, she's a musician, but is she a pop musician? Not really,
Let's call her singer-songwriter. And she has been in a movie. She was definitely in Mona Lisa Smile. So get that on your stage. Who would be Julia Roberts, though? You, I guess.
I don't think so. Well, I'm trying to think of... We did Steel Dragnolias.
I saw that.
Yeah, yeah. So Malay Balenciaga played Julia Roberts.
I mean, that's ideal.
Yeah,
truly.
So it was pretty fabulous. Yes,
I couldn't tell them apart. I can't tell them apart. They're like, who's who? I'm not kidding.
It just happened. It just, Malay is black.
All right, and that is part of my concern. I know.
See, in my world, I can take a cult movie and twist and turn it and queer it to be whatever I want it to be, right?
Of course.
In my universe, we don't really stick to the traditions of gender or race or age or any of that,
Who, though, is the Julia Roberts of drag, if you had to say?
Oh, God, good question. The Julia Roberts of drag.
And I'm going to think of my answer, too.
I have to say that I feel like there's these movie stars that come out and they're very cool. And I feel like this about Julia Roberts and Reese Witherspoon did very cool movies in the early part of their career, right? Like Mystic Pizza or for Julia or Freeway.
I knew you were going to say, I said it before you said it, just you so you it. Knew that I knew.
Yeah. Election. Then they get a hit, right? So for Julia, it was obviously Pretty Woman, and their star is catapulted to, the outer stratosphere.
Of non-interesting roles, yes.
And then they do a ton of non-interesting roles.
Sweet Home Alabama,
like,
talking to
you. Who can blame them, right? But I feel like both those actors are so talented that despite all the shitty movies, they've sort of circled back to doing interesting things again.
Yeah,
I love Julia on... Homecoming, if you saw the Steven Soderbergh TV series.
Did I watch Homecoming? There's no way.
Oh, gosh.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I loved it. And Little Fires Everywhere for Reese.
Okay, that I watched.
Well, Reese now is obsessed with playing Karen. She does it very well.
That scream she did.
Yeah.
I mean, it was no Meryl season 2 of Big Little Lies.
That's true.
It worked.
It worked. But yeah, I have to say, so as far as drag performers... Let's see. So that's a very long way of saying, I think both those people, Julia and Reese, I guess I would say, like, in my world, it would be maybe like Jinx and Dayla, you know,
two people
that I think, you know, they're my drag family. Jinx is actually my drag daughter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that they have the big talent. And then they got on this big TV show. And then they did some, you know, maybe for better or worse, some kind of, you know, tired drag tours, you know, with the Rue roster of talent. Mm-hmm. And, you mm-hmm. know, and now they're doing these incredible things like making their own movies and putting out albums. And, you know, they're just so talented that, you know, they used that popular TV show, which we all love, it's entertaining, to you know, explode. And and now I feel like they are really doing it the right way. And I would say Bob the Drag Queen too, you know, another superstar, my other drag daughter, who is so talented. That, yeah, I feel like Reese and Julia, they're in it for the long haul, you know?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Did Reese do herself any favors by surrounding herself with the best actresses in the world on Big Little Lies? I don't know. I can't say.
I think she did. You know why? Mm. Because I felt like this is the thing with drag racing, gay people. Everything now is a competition, right? Like, maybe mm-hmm. we don't need to watch Big Little Lies and decide who did the best job. Maybe we can just watch
we
it.
But do.
Everyone wants, you know. And
I need my women to be competing against one another at all times. Otherwise, why am I supporting them? I'm not kidding.
Okay. I have to say, I watched Big Little Lies, and I really believed it to be a great ensemble thing. Like, if you put a gun to my head and I said, you said, who could I not live without? Of course I'm going to choose Laura Dern. You know, I'm like,
good for you. You
know, I'm that kind of gay. But I thought Reese was awesome. I thought Nicole Kidman was great.
That's my pick. Sorry.
You know, oh, Nicole.
Yeah.
Well, I thought she's Kravitz was great. And
Kravitz came into her own in season two.
She did.
Oh.
Yeah. She did.
Oh my God. Yeah, the other one was so good. I don't know the one.
I forget her name too.
The teen actress that's in like those herd immunity movies.
Yeah,
she was great.
She was excellent.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like when my women compete for my attention. You know, it reminds me that I have a place in the patriarchy, even though I'm gay.
Oh wow. Okay. Well,
I did, and I feel it.
Come a canceling. You know?
I would love to be big enough to get canceled one of these days. Pray for me.
Right. Okay. That's. I love that we've reached the point now where you. Mm-hmm. I think I might feel the same way you are.
No. You could be canceled.
I said it. Well, the other thing about canceling me is kind of like, look, I set out to be canceled. You know, you don't name yourself after Jesus and beg for being protested and screen, you know, really problematic movies for years and years because you don't want to upset people, you know. So I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, cancel me, whatever.
But the Christians are not the ones canceling people, though, right?
That's exactly right. That's the hilarious thing.
We're the ones that have the power. And good for us.
Even back then, I have to say, even when I started drag, especially being a horror queen, when there really weren't any, there were plenty. Like, my show wasn't necessarily a homosexual audience. It was definitely a queer audience, but it was very also... well, John Waters calls my audience heteroflexible. And I think what that means is sort of like, it was punk rock. It was the rockabilly kids. It was like punk rockers and you know, queer outlaws. But mainstream gay culture, like, did not want me around. You know, me and my ilk were not welcome to the pride parades. We were not, you know, we weren't really celebrated in the Castro. We certainly weren't celebrated by the institutions in San Francisco, which is hilarious now because, you know, I'm hosting, you know, I co-produce a night at the symphony.
Like, yeah, she sold out. You know, I know.
The big symphony or whatever. And I'm just kind of like laughing to myself because I'm like, these are the same people who were nauseated by me.
Oh, yeah. So, that's horror, though, right? We are not allowed to play. Every once in a while, we'll get an Oscar nomination, and they'll call us a thriller, and I get so nauseated. But
right, like Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. You know,
it's sort of like, it's not a thriller.
It's not a thriller.
It's a frickin' horror movie.
John Krasinski refuses to call A Quiet Place horror, and he calls it, like, thriller, and I am nauseated by this attitude.
That's really a bummer. That reminds me of drag queens who say, I'm not a drag queen, you know, Lipsinka went through this phase where she was an actor. And it's like,
oh no.
I mean, I love you. I think you're amazing. Your name is fucking Lipsinka, and you built a career around lip syncing to Joan Crawford's dialogue. Like, you're a drag queen. You're like the definition of a drag queen. You can't deny that now because you're above it.
Listen, I relate to any form of internalized hatred, and I respect it, and I celebrate it.
Oh my God, so, you're hilarious. I love it.
You. Pivoting back, coming back to Earth. Today we're talking about Trick or Treat 2. I'm so excited about it because I'm obsessed with Trick or Treat 1. I'm wondering what our general relationships with Trick or Treat are. Like, when was the first time we saw it? Like, why do we love it? And why did you pick it as a topic?
Okay, so great question. I'm gonna preface this with the caveat that I have a terrible memory, and so I will do my best. What I do know about Trick or Treat is that I definitely saw it at home, because my reaction after seeing it, I think it might have been like from, you know, like Netflix or something, but when you used to get the DVDs, like way back when, right? But I remember very specifically my reaction being, what the hell? I cannot believe that did not get a theatrical. And like, it just seemed shocking to me that it was sort of something that people weren't talking more about outside of the genre community, you know? And I'm sure that I was pushed to see it because I've always stayed connected to the genre community. And actually, they were working on Trick or Treat around the same time that I was working on my feature film. And so, you know, I remember it being out there. And I think I was in the film festival just after they were. So it was still something that was talked about a lot in the film festival scene. So I went to Sitges with All About Evil, my film. And I went to Toronto After Dark and a bunch of places where...
That's where I am.
That's where you are. So you know what festival I'm talking about. So Trick or Treat had played all those festivals and people were still talking about it. So when I finally got to see it, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I loved it, you know, and I love anthology films. And I was a kid who grew up worshiping Creepshow, and I love Halloween. And it just hit on, it really, really hit on every sort of nerve that I would want a really good modern Halloween anthology movie to do. And you know, when you love something so much and you love a theme or an idea so much that you actually are more likely to be disappointed by the
flying too close to the sun.
Yes. So that was my fear. I thought I was going to, you know, be disappointed, but no. I love Trick or Treat. And then I did that thing where, you know, when you see a movie and you're like, oh, well, now I just have to show it to every fucking person I know. So I watched it like 10 times because I would invite people over and have screenings and show it, you know. So that was my experience with it.
Oh, God. It's an annual look. You know what? I watched it so many times that I turned on it and I hadn't seen it, I don't know, in years. And are you watching it for this? I've never been happier. It like, I
holds
was like,
up,
oh,
right?
Well, it more than holds up. I'm like, this, I forgot. This is my identity. This is who I am. And that, and it really like, it brought lots of joy into my heart. Okay. Well, we're going to get back to Trick or Treat. I promise. Maybe we'll see. I want to talk to you a little bit about Halloween, because the heart of Trick or Treat obviously is that it captures Halloween literally perfectly, which is so hard to do. So
it's almost a fantasy of what Halloween should be.
Oh, exactly. It's like what Halloween was when we were a kid, where like it literally was a little bit dangerous and it was scary, but you are so drawn to it. And it was, absolutely. Do you have like any early Halloween memories or like scary Halloween memories that you'd be able to share?
Yes, I actually, so I my memory is stronger the further back we go. It's almost like the older I've gotten, the more I've run out of data.
Or you started drinking at a certain age and then.
Yeah, oh, please. definitely. But I, so my mother is, it's funny now because she, you know, is an older woman. She lives alone and she decorates for Halloween every year and goes over the top. And And I was talking to her about it, and I said, you know what's funny? I didn't realize that we were, like, the family that was super into Halloween. Like, I thought this was something, like, everyone experienced. And my mom was like, oh, no. Like, I loved Halloween. Your father loved Halloween. And we raised you all to love Halloween. And so that's why we went all out every year. And my dad would, you know, take not just us, but all of the neighborhood kids trick-or-treating and hook up a wagon to his little tractor and drive us around the neighborhood. And,
oh my God, you know, I love it.
My, you know, family. Yeah, it was very much our holiday. And then I was obsessed with the Haunted Mansion. I was obsessed with haunted houses. So they started bringing me to that stuff at a pretty young age. And then I started making that stuff, you know, in the basement, and then kind of it getting bigger and bigger and making it for, you know, the entire neighborhood. You know, when I was in high school and stuff, I'd do these elaborate haunted, they were haunted trails. They were outside, but I would write scripts and, you know, cast it all and build sets. And my mother would sell the tickets, and my father would take the chain off the chainsaw, and he would be the finale guy. And, you know, and that was my first real taste of producing and show business and writing and directing. So long story short, Halloween was huge in my family and my upbringing.
I love that. Was your dad as into it, or was he just lovely and supportive?
Well, here's the thing. I was such a weirdo and so gay and so dark and into everything spooky. You know, I was definitely, you know, an Addams Family kid, if one was a big flamer. And I think that it was actually one of the things that my father could kind of bond with me over. Like, I think he enjoyed it. He understood it. He's a CPA. He's a Republican. You know, like, we didn't necessarily have tons in common, but he did get into, he understood my spirit for liking showmanship and the haunted houses. So to this day, I have a haunted attraction company in San Francisco. And, you know, my dad won't fly out. I grew up in Maryland, so he won't fly out for my big, you know, drag shows at the Castro Theater and those events. But he has flown out more than once to see my immersive haunted attraction. So, you know, still he's into that part of my, you know.
I love that. I also relate so hard. Is me and my dad, like, I would say 90% of what we relate to is through horror. And I don't say that with any sadness in my heart. It's more than enough, you know?
And it's better than nothing. I mean, I have friends who have nothing in common with either parent or whatever.
Oh, yeah. And we sort of discovered horror together. Like, he was never into it. And then I was really fascinated with it. And my mom wouldn't let me rent it. So we would on the weekends. And that's how we sort of bonded. So
yeah, that's great.
Dads and horror, very cute.
What was your, like, what's your most favorite Halloween costume, you know, from when you were a kid?
I had to be Dracula every year for,
that's classic.
I don't know, 10 years. And there was this lady that had, like, was always dressed up as a really scary witch. And I remember if I'm a vampire, like, it's sort of like rock, paper, scissors, like, vampires beat witches, I will be fine. And every year I would try to go to her house, and she'd, like, see me coming, and I would panic and not be able to do it. So shout out to that lady. I wonder if she really was a witch.
What if it was my mom?
Oh my God, what if it was you?
That's true.
The witch clan.
Yeah.
That was my fave. Did you have, like, a best Halloween of your life?
No, not really. I will say this about it. I think that when you grow up a kid who loves Halloween and drag and, you know, October is your, you know, that's my pride month, I guess. You know, my really happy month is October. Okay. But when you make a career out of it accidentally and then find yourself, you know, overextended and overbooked, it's like Halloween season went from being my favorite, most fun time of the year to my most stressful, overbooked, you know, sleep deprived, you know, workaholic season. So,
oh my God, that's a monkey's paw.
It kind of, you know, and so now I'm post-pandemic. You know, one of the things about the pandemic that was sort of good for me, I guess, is just sort of saying, hey, I like this life where I don't work all the time. I think maybe I need to have more of a live-work balance. And
what? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a thing. So
no,
even with this coming October, you know, I'm just kind of designing my life so that, yes, it'll be a lot of work, but I also think I'm going to enjoy it more because I'm not going to overdo it.
Yeah, you deserve to have a spooky season. I believe that with all my heart. And I also find it's sort of like what other people go through with birthdays or weddings, where like they build it up and there's like a real fear of it not going right. I have that with spooky season. Like October 3rd, I'm already a little depressed that it's almost over.
Wow. Yeah, that's intense.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
No, I hear you. I relate. I get it.
What do you think the relationship between Halloween and drag is? You kind of touched on it, and we hear about it in the wild, but I was wondering if you have an answer.
Well, I mean, everyone calls Halloween, well, not everyone, but a lot of people call Halloween gay Christmas. And I think a big part of that is that we as kids, I mean, I was shamed for being a sissy, for being effeminate, for being girl-like as a little boy, right? So, you know, you kind of stuff those feelings down. And I was drawn to theater. I was drawn to drama. I wanted to wear costumes. I wanted to, you know, express myself. And I think Halloween was this one time of the year where you kind of got this free pass, you know, to sort of put on a costume. And you know, for me, especially because I liked spooky stuff, it was just everything. I used to think that I was super unique in this regard, but we know now lots of queer people love horror. Oh, lots of queer people love dark stuff and goth stuff and weird stuff and love Halloween. And so it makes sense to me because it's like, you know, Christmas, while lovely for a lot of people, it's also centered around family and tradition and religion. Halloween is centered around, you know, fucking witches and darkness and dressing up, you know, and doing drag. So, you know, it is gay Christmas.
And being slutty. That's a huge part of it.
Oh, yeah. That is a big part of it, which is, and let's face it, that's a big part of being gay. So,
a huge part of being gay. And and thank God, like, we're so lucky that we get that with less shame than the other half.
It's true. And, you know, Halloween, honestly, as far as relationships to drag go, now, this wasn't the case for me, but I know for a lot of drag queens, it's sort of the gateway drag or gateway drug to drag is Halloween. You know, these guys put on, you know, a costume for the first time and you know, they say, oh, I'm going to be Dolly Parton for Halloween. Isn't that hilarious? And then, you know, it's time to take off the costume and it's
these
tits they're going back on next weekend.
Exactly. That's actually where I was nudging you. I wanted you to give me that answer. And then you did.
Yeah.
So thank you. All right. Enough about Halloween in general.
Yeah.
Halloween horror. Do we have favorite Halloween horror movies specifically? The answer can be no.
Well, I mean, it's going to sound so cliched, but it is my favorite Halloween movie, which is Halloween, you know, and it's kind of like, how can it not be?
Yeah, not cliche. Classique, not cliche.
Yeah, it is, you know, if Halloween horror is a genre, then the movie, John Carpenter's Halloween is the Citizen Kane, you know, it is the pinnacle, you know, and yeah, and Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie Strode is you know, you know, but like talk about the ultimate final girl. I mean, it just, you know, it's a perfect film. It is. Yeah.
I joke, but not joke, that I believe pop culture was invented in 1978. Like nothing happened before, except for, I guess, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, if you like want it to.
Right.
But it started with Halloween. That's it. There was no media before that.
It definitely changed everything, that's for sure.
When did Kate Bush come out? It must have been around then.
Early 80s? Maybe late 70s, yeah.
I think late 70s. Okay, well, then then maybe her too.
Yeah.
Halloween, incredible franchise. The first movie, truly beautiful, really captures that sense of suburban horror, which Halloween is all about.
Yes.
I hope this is racist. I love that Europe doesn't really understand Halloween. Do you know what I mean by that? Like,
I'm so, you know, stupid American and grew up thinking that, you know, everyone loves what we love. That you know, when I started leaving the country for the first time, I was so shocked that like, they didn't understand Halloween. Yeah,
they want to. I feel like they do want to understand it, but they don't. They elevate like the whole slasher scream element, and they don't really understand like the harvest nostalgia cornucopia vibe. And the example that I love to give is, you're gay, so hopefully you understand. Did you, the second Aqua album that nobody listened to but the gays had a song called Halloween on it, and they just do not understand the holiday. And I really recommend it to anyone listening. Listen to Aqua's Halloween. It's very funny.
I will have to check that out. Yeah, I think you're completely right. I will say this, in the, you know, many years that now I've been traveling for work, they are definitely moving more aggressively to do something for Halloween.
Good.
They, you know, haunted attractions now have exploded all over the UK and
finally
Germany. And yeah, so they, but you know, I mean, how late are they with all that? You know, so you're right. It's like they don't, you're completely right. They have this sort of modern take on it without any of the classic finesse.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all about the vibe. It's about it being 1996. You're like in the country at like a grocery store and there's weird decorations up and there's like a weird uncanny vibe. And that's what Halloween is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any favorite Halloween like TV specials or like TV episodes? Is there anything that comes to
mind? Well, I mean, for just sheer kitsch factor, I would say the Paul Lynde Halloween special with Kiss and Margaret Hamilton. You know, it's 70s kitsch galore. I mean, and you would think almost that they did it intentionally, and you can watch it online.
Okay.
It's like that old style televised variety show, like the Sonny and Cher show, but it's Paul Lynde, who's the gayest of gay, you know, way back then. And that, I mean, just the fact that he has Margaret Hamilton, you know, and Witchy Poo from H.R. Puff and Stuff, which these probably are all references.
The one reference I don't understand is that last one. I'd like to know more about it. Can you just give me a quick rundown on what Witchy Poo is?
Yeah, so H.R. Puff and Stuff was a children's TV show created by Sid Croft. And it was almost like being on acid or something. Like there were these giant, you know, Muppet puppets and boy with a talking flute and, you know, magical creatures. And it was just very trippy and very wild. And there's this great character, a witch, and her name in the show was Witchy Poo. And actually the actress who played her died last year during the pandemic. So yeah, but she was definitely a kooky old witch. And you should, you know, definitely check Witchy Poo out. Check H.R. Puff and Stuff out. Her name was Billie Hayes, and she passed away last year. But this Paul Lynde Halloween special, just the fact that he had these people on, oh my God, it's so amazing. I guess that would be my favorite Halloween
show. I mean, it sounds incredible, so I have to find it. You had me at Kiss.
Yeah, Kiss is part of it.
That's it. That's enough.
And Florence Henderson, Tim Conway. I mean, it's Betty White is in it. It's like really, it needs to be seen to be believed.
I cannot wait to watch it this Halloween.
Yeah.
I'm going to say for my answer is going to be my best friend Emily got me one year for Halloween, like the DVD collection of every Roseanne Halloween special. This exists.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And that's going to be my answer because they have literally for every season they did a Halloween episode and they were
all incredible. I did not know that.
Yeah, she's Halloween obsessive.
So you can get, so they marketed and packaged just the
official
Halloween specials.
Just the Halloween specials. And there's like eight of them.
That. I'm going to check that out. Okay, you're going to watch Paul Lynde and I'm going to watch the Roseanne one. You know what they should do is they should do that same thing, and they probably already have, but with The Simpsons, because that was always, you know, another great.
Well, I was literally, that was next on my docket, was I was going to say favorite Treehouse of Horrors segment, or like, what's a segment that comes to you when you think Treehouse of Horrors, what appears in your mind's eye?
Oh God, that's a good question.
I'll edit out these pauses, so it's going to sound you're going to sound so off the cuff. You're going to sound like literally improv queen.
Well, I mean, of course, I love parodies to horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
So probably the more, and I'm obsessed with Poltergeist. Ugh. So probably maybe their Poltergeist Amityville horror one.
I don't remember there being a Poltergeist. Oh, yes, I think
yes,
I do.
There was.
Where they move into like a scary house and then they scare them on the ghosts, kind of. Yeah.
Yes. And that's also the Nightmare on Elm Street one.
Yes, with that one, I was obsessed with growing up. That one, anything Freddy, I needed to be obsessed with. Because
what is yours?
Okay, this is not a good one, but because I'm so obsessed with I Know What You Did Last Summer, they do a Flanders I Know What You Did Last Summer parody at one point, and I have to say that's up there for me. The Shining is a good one.
The Shining is the other one that I really, really remember.
And there's one that's really, truly unhinged and grotesque, where all the teachers at the school like start making all the children, like they start eating all the children. It's like they chop them up.
Oh,
and, like,
wow.
It's really brutal and disgusting, and I am obsessed with it.
Love that.
Thank you. I appreciate. Okay, so next up, and we've already touched on it, but I'm coming back around.
Okay.
Michael Myers Halloween franchise. Obviously, the first one's incredible. I want to dig a little deeper, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Would you say the first one's your favorite?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, well, by far.
Give me another one. What of the sequels are you near and dear?
Well, I love the aesthetic to Season of the Witch because it's so
wild answer.
Well, I feel like it's very Halloween, like the holiday with the masks and the Shamrock Song, and I love the nostalgia for the 80s that it brings up. But I would agree with people, and they talk about this in on that documentary In Search of Darkness, where, you know, it bombed because it really had no business being in the Halloween franchise.
Yeah, people were
right. Like it had nothing to do with Michael Myers or the franchise. And I would agree with that. Like, so I think the reason I like it now is because I have nostalgia for it, you know, and I did watch it as a kid growing up. And then beyond that, I do like Halloween too, you know. So I guess
Thank you.
I guess I'm one of those people. I've heard people say, "Oh, Halloween 2 is not very good." It's like,
oh, I love it.
I love it. I really enjoy it. I mean, is it as good as Halloween? No, but you know, it's still
it's
great.
A different thing. I'm obsessed with Halloween 2. When I was younger, I liked it more. Now that I'm older and wiser, I understand that that's disgusting and unacceptable. But I love hospital horror. Really does it for me.
Yes.
Are you a Buffy fan?
No, sadly. Okay,
well, never mind. You know what? I'm not gonna grace you with this reference.
Well, here's the thing. I'm not a fan.
Clearly are not a fan. Sorry.
I it's not that I've watched Buffy and decided I don't like it. In fact, a ton of people have convinced me that I would love Buffy. I just need to sit down and watch it.
No,
yeah, I think
late.
It is too late.
It is too late. Yeah, it's too late.
Yeah.
And I think less of you, and that's okay. what did you think of the recent reboot, Halloween 2018?
Oh, gosh. Oh, the reboot. I thought we were going to talk about the Rob Zombie ones.
I mean, we can.
Okay, so I have thoughts about both.
Okay, let's hear them. If you have time, I have time.
Sure. Okay, so I'll start with the Rob Zombie reboots, or I guess remakes. Not a fan. And, I like Rob Zombie as an icon.
Me
I
too.
Like the music. I actually really liked House of a Thousand Corpses. In fact,
how could you not?
You know, I love it. And the brilliant cinematographer from that film actually is the cinematographer from my feature film. And it was one of the things that we, you know, bonded over was me talking about, you know, working with Rob Zombie. And
what's
I admire
name?
Rob Zombie. Tom Richmond is his
cool.
name. Very talented DP. And I quite like The Devil's Rejects. This is my problem with the remake mostly. And we touched on it a little bit. You brought it up. Halloween, the original Halloween, I think what makes it so titillating is that it is set in affluent white America, you know, or upper middle class. Like these white people clearly have a nice life. They don't have to lock their doors. They come home, you know, from, it looks like an evening out, and their, you know, spoiled kid has just, you know, brutally murdered his sister, right? So he's evil. And I like that's where the torture starts. That's where the fear begins, that this is something born out of privilege. And with Rob's remake, it's like, it's that cliched, tired idea that poor people are dangerous. And we've seen it so much. It's like, he made the kid's mother, you know, like a sex worker, a dancer. The kid lives in a trailer. You know, it's like all these cliches about poor people. And it just, mm-hmm. to me, it was like, this is not that interesting. Like, I really like the idea that Michael Myers is of the suburban, you know, upper middle class, and was mm-hmm. born in this culture, and you know that evil yeah. can lurk in these.
It wasn't places. Made. There wasn't trauma there, that exactly. we know of, right?
Exactly.
He's just the devil's eyes.
So that's really my biggest problem with it, more than anything.
And I like that.
Yeah,
you're making it about. I don't think anyone's ever like done that much of a take on Rob Zombies, so I think you did it justice.
Well, he's obsessed with poor people. I mean, and I'm not saying that that's a problem. I mean, other directors I love, John Waters, clearly, you know, is kind of obsessed with poor people, especially in his early films. But I think when with Rob, there's sort of this idea of them being dangerous, you know, that goes hand in hand with this, you know, this idea of what it's like to be poor, and it's like, no, not so much, you know.
Yeah, it's a little problematic, and also it's so much less scary. I
it's
agree
cliched too. It's tired.
Yeah, and also like it's so not poor people, but that film. It's just like so just not fun. It's not fun. It's not
just
like
brutal.
It's gross.
Yeah, agreed.
I think Octavia Spencer.
One, oh my god, yeah. It's even worse.
I prefer the second one just because of how unhinged it is.
Yeah, maybe because it's like this is how much we don't give a shit. Yeah,
this is yes, and I like the later game sequels that are like absolutely unnecessary, terrible. And right. The second one had that energy a little bit. Well, the first one was so serious.
Agreed.
Anyways, they're both terrible. I hate them both.
Right.
And I don't love the reboot either. Sorry.
Me neither. And I went into it so hopeful. I mean, I am a diehard Jamie Lee Curtis fan. So my, you know, my, I guess expectations admittedly were very, very high. And I thought maybe we were going to get back into, I don't know, like that the universe that the first movie had sort
feel.
Of created, where, you know, let's face it, one of the reasons it's so effective is because Laurie Strode and the women in that film feel very real. They feel, you know, very centered in reality, whereas this reboot, it's like, wait, we're now it like she's Sarah Connor from
Terminator 2? It doesn't make any sense. I think it's Deborah Hill. I think she was on
maybe.
Set.
Yeah.
And she like ensured that these girls were girls and not weird like male gaze versions.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. I mean, Deborah Hill, obviously, you know, someone really, I hope there's going to be a big Deborah Hill, you know, documentary because, you know, what, it's clear that Deborah Hill had a magic touch and really worked, you know, in a way where her participation affected the outcome of the film and was a great producer. And yeah, it's like, I don't know, that reboot. And I know actually Judy Greer. I love Judy. I was really rooting for the movie to be great. Not only did I not buy Laurie Strode as the Terminator, you know, Sarah Connor or whatever. I also didn't buy any of the kids. Like they were awful. I didn't like them. And I mean, I love the teens in the first Halloween. You really root for them.
They're cute.
You know, and what is it about some writers where they can really write for young people in a way that makes us like them? And then others who just can't. Like there wasn't a likable teen in that Halloween reboot, you know?
Because it's made by straight men. Where's Kevin Williamson?
Maybe that's it. I don't know. But like, I have to say, I was really impressed with that first. I haven't seen the whole trilogy, but I was impressed with the first Fear Street.
Yes, me too.
Because I was like, okay, I don't find it scary. I wasn't scared watching it. But I was really sad when certain kills happened, you know, like when the, you know, the fabulous bread slicer kill, it was like,
so grateful for that kill.
I'm feeling something for her.
Yes,
I
and it's
like
been a long
her. Yeah. Yes. They did.
And when the boy gets it in the head, it's like,
yes.
You're shocked.
I was
you
shocked.
Don't expect it, you know,
no.
it subverts your expectations, which is beautiful. I will tell you the second two are better. They're even better. The
All
first
right,
one
well,
is
I,
good.
But I will continue then. Yeah, I kind of was saving it a little bit.
And it's queer, and it's made by a woman. This is the horror that we need. This is what I want.
Well, that is, I mean, yes, good point. Because we are at this place where more of us have a seat at the table. And like I said, I've been in the horror game for a long, long time. I mean, you know, when I was literally the only openly queer person, you know, at a horror film festival. And I say that, and it's like, no, it really is true. Like, you know, or the only drag queen within, you know, miles of a horror convention or whatever. And it started to feel like nobody wants me here. I mean, there were, of course, people that were into it, you know, and often I would be there like with Elvira or whoever. And, you know, it was just so funny to me that for those men that were really hanging on to that genre and had kind of dominated it as a sort of a macho boys club thing, I was a threat. You know, they didn't like the idea that I was going to maybe camp up their horror in a way they didn't like. And the tables have turned, you know, like finally we have women at the table. We have Black folks at the table. We have, you know, international horror films being, you know, celebrated and queer people making horror movies. And it's like such an exciting time to be a horror fan again.
I couldn't agree more, but at the end of the day, all I want is another Freddy movie. Give me a Freddy movie.
Okay, so Freddy's my favorite.
That's what I need.
Yeah, I love, love, love Freddy. I would love another Freddy movie.
But
I will say this. As a Freddy-obsessed fan who, you know, grew up with Freddy and worshipped Freddy, there is a point in the franchise where he jumped the shark so hard. That if they do another Freddy movie, I'm going to be pretty anal about, you know, like, can we please bring Freddy back from, you know, Dream Warriors and, you know, before? Freddy from the TV series or the MTV, you know, television commercials.
I would love to do a podcast dedicated to Freddy's nightmares. So if anyone's listening and wants to invest, Yeah, one of these days. I hear Spectre Vision, Elijah Wood's horror company, has a pitch for a new Freddy, and I'm absolutely all ears. Also, Robert Englund at one point said they were thinking about remaking the third. Have you heard about this?
Really?
So that, yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, so Dream Warriors was my sort of, I don't know, like, saw it when it came out. You know, I was too young to see it. I was in like seventh or eighth grade, saw it at the cinema. And it was like that thing where it was like, holy shit, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. It's changed my life. You know, I'm fully obsessed. I mean, now, again, I was one of many, many kids who was turned on to that movie and turned on to Freddy. And it would be interesting if they do a remake, because so many of us were obsessed with Dream Warriors, you know, could it capture the magic, you know, and some remakes, you know, some reboots I do like. I'm not one of those people who's like, same, you can't remake anything, you know? Oh yeah. The Thing, my God.
Oh, please. Like, you know, give me remakes, good and bad. I want them all, but yeah.
Well, here's my question to you. What's interesting about Nightmare is do it now, because Robert, you know, with the makeup, could still play him.
He could,
you know,
it.
You know, yeah. It's like he might, I mean, you know, he might have to go on a diet or something. I don't know, what he looks like these days, but hey, that's doable. You know, it actors is. Do it all the time. You know, it's like Harrison Ford is playing fucking Indiana Jones again. Freddy Krueger isn't going to look any different, you know, with the makeup on.
No.
So,
I mean, listen, did you not see him on that episode of The Goldbergs? They brought him.
I did. Yeah. And he looked great.
He did look great. It didn't look the same, but he did look great. Yes, it has to be him, truly. Yeah. Although, Jackie O'Haley was not the problem with the remake, and that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, it's funny, the male lead in All About Evil, Thomas Dekker, left the set of All About Evil to go do
the remake.
Remake. So I was getting, you know, intel while it was happening, because, you know, I was like, Thomas, I need to know everything. I'm obsessed. Oh, God. And then I went to see the movie with Thomas.
Cool.
It was so awkward because I couldn't hide it afterwards, you know, and Thomas is going, okay, so what did you think? And Thomas knew what I was going to think. Like, Thomas, and Thomas, I shouldn't even be talking for him on your podcast.
Do it.
But let me just say this. I think Thomas predicted what was going to happen. You know, he had already warned me that I wasn't going to like it. You know, if you catch my drift,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
he's not dumb.
He was pretty aware. And when we went to see it together, he had already seen it. So it wasn't like he was seeing it for the first time. So he was like looking at me afterwards and he said, "Oh my God, you really hated it, didn't you?" And I said, "Yeah. You know, it's that thing where when you love something so much, it's like, it's better for me to just ignore it in a way." And he was like, "Okay, I understand that." I was like, I don't even think we should talk about it because I'm going to get all worked up, you know?
Understandable.
Yeah. And I felt the same way, but I never went to see Poltergeist because I knew, you know, I care about Poltergeist so much.
It was an abomination. I like Poltergeist, but it's not my number one.
Right.
It was, I think, maybe one of the worst remakes I'd ever seen. So don't watch it. Stay away. That would be a good one to remake well, though, or make them into like an HBO series. Who cares? Something.
I really like these remakes where they take what was maybe a great idea, but it didn't quite have the budget, or, you know, a great idea, but it wasn't made into a great film. You know, I loved Romero's, the remake of The Crazies.
Oh, it
was fabulous. And I actually liked the Wes Craven Hills Have Eyes reboot.
Yeah, that was great too. Aja.
That was fabulous. Yes.
Aja from Drag Race directed that.
Yeah, she's also a French horror film.
The early 2000s. Yeah, that was brutal. The second one was also truly gross.
And I loved them both. And I thought, this is really smart because Wes Craven, obviously, what a visionary genius, you know. And Wes advised on it, right? So it's like he basically said, "I didn't have the money to do X, Y, Z. You have the budget now. You should do it this way." And they did. And I think that those are the more interesting, you know, remakes, you know, The Fly, you know, taking that sort of concept from a 50s schlocky B movie and then turning it into, you know, a Cronenberg masterpiece. Those are really interesting remakes.
Absolutely. I like all the remakes that you're liking are from before the remake trend. These are like the occasional remakes that would come out every once in a while, but this was before like the 2000s booms.
I do have an exception to that though.
Oh, give it.
I love the original. Like, it's one of my, you know, I worship it. But I actually did enjoy the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it.
Oh, it's good. Me and my dad actually walked out of it because it was too scary. But I have watched it many times since, and it's great. It's brutal though.
Yeah.
I also think it started the trend of like horror heroines wearing cute, pristine little tank tops, because you had that in that movie. You had it in House of Wax. You had it in Wrong Turn. You're gonna start noticing.
Yeah.
I'm gonna write an article about it. So,
and I loved House of Wax. I liked that whole William Castle period, you know, where they did 13 ghosts.
Oh, I talk about it all the time. I need to start a Dark Castle cast because I am obsessed with Dark Castle. Not the originals, but the remakes.
Right.
Yeah, 13 Ghosts, House on Haunted Hill.
Yeah.
Even Orphan, I guess, was pretty good.
Oh,
and then
Orphan?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. Incredible.
Oh my God, I love that. That's another one kind of like Trick or Treat where I saw it and not enough of my friends had seen it. So I sort of delighted in, you know, hosting little, you know, screenings of it.
That ending is still shocking. We're still talking about that ending to this day. And you can't take that away from that movie.
Yeah, for sure.
It's one of those movies that you talk about it because of the ending. Is there anything else that's like, oh yeah, Sleepaway Camp. That movie's defined by that ending.
Well, yes, and that one I've actually done, you know, events for.
I mean, how could you not have?
Yeah, and you know, got protested.
From the good side and the bad side, they'd both have arguments
for that one. Yeah.
I'm desperate to do an episode on the fourth movie. There was Sleepaway Camp 4 called The Survivor. Have you heard about this?
No.
Yeah, it's very obscure. So they filmed, so the sequels to Sleepaway Camp were you know, hardly films, basically. They were like very low budge. And they were making a fourth, and halfway through, they just scrapped the production for whatever reason. And eventually down the line, they like edited it together and sort of released it. And it's just the hottest mess you'll ever find. It also has an amazing poster if you ever need to Google it.
Oh. And Flitz of Rose is in this one.
No, I believe that's even later down the line. They brought her back. This was like still in the 90s. It's Sleepaway Camp 4, The Survivor. If you're out there and you've seen it, you know.
Oh, no, I'm looking at it. It's funny. It's called The Sleepaway for the Survivor. I love the poster.
Isn't it so good?
Yeah, and it's considered the fifth installment, but the fourth chronologically.
Oh, wow. My goodness.
To be fair, I only really remember the first two.
Yeah, I remember seeing the second one not long ago and being like really shocked by the transphobia in it. The first one, like the transphobia was but...
Well, it's a different kind of thing. Like the first one, the first one's kind of almost more homophobic. Like, you know, the whole idea, like this all was set into motion really when the shock of someone's gay father, you know, set this boat into a boating disaster. Like,
what a weird opening sequence. Yes, that is impossible to understand. Impossible to understand.
And this like idea, this anti-main character, you know,
kind of R.I.P.
Yeah, R.I.P. recently as well. But yeah,
I'm shocked that was. I really thought that was a drag queen. Really, even as a child.
Well, the performance, my God, yeah,
of course, incredible.
It's so good. But yeah, you're right. Like the second one, I actually think is just more like that kind of gross, blatant transphobia.
The first 5 minutes, they were like, and they chopped off her dick, and now she's a tranny killing everyone. And I was like, whoa, calm down.
But then it's kind of great.
Oh, it's incredible.
She's killing them all.
She really is.
Yeah.
And she's living her best life. Good for her. That's a good for her subgenre right there.
Right.
I'm going to be really boring, and I'm just going to give us a little bit of history on Trick or Treat 1. Just because I think we need it. We got it. So the first film, Trick or Treat, actually started off as a animated short in 1996 called Season's Greetings. It's online. I definitely recommend checking it out. It was on a DVD extra. We were talking about how it was made in 2007, but it didn't get released. Warner Brothers buried it. And the reason for that is because they were too spooked to market a horror anthology. Like, they didn't know what to do with it. So they made this big budget horror movie and then sat on it for 2 years and then just dropped it on DVD, which is just so disrespectful.
So weird. It's so weird. I still feel like there's more to that story we don't know.
Oh, of course.
I'm like, this doesn't make sense. Like, what do you mean you don't know how to... horror anthologies have been marketed successfully for decades now.
Absolutely, they have, man.
Come on.
Do you have favorite horror anthologies? You mentioned Creepshow. How could you not? Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. But when people talk about Creepshow, I feel like their favorite segment is never Father's Day. And it always shocks me because it's such the standout to me.
Well, I mean, so my favorite segment of Creepshow, the first one, probably is Father's Day.
Thank Delia goodness.
And yeah, I mean, it's
Where's my cake?
Yeah, it's flawless. But my favorite segment actually is from part two.
Oh, I know where you're going.
Yeah, so it's Thanks for the Ride, Lady. So,
oh, that's not where I thought you were going at all.
Oh, that's my favorite. Yeah.
That's so funny. Good for you. That is not a common favorite. So I really celebrate that as your favorite.
I just love that it's playing on. I mean, it's like it's
oh my God,
a Karen movie, you know, from back in the day, you know, like way back when, like this racist bitch, you know, thinks she can get away with this shit. And yeah, it's pretty audacious. In fact, the second one is very woke in a way. You know, you've got the Native American killer. I mean, I love The Raft. Don't get me wrong.
I thought that you were going to say The Raft because it's so clearly the standout. No offense.
I'll say this. The Raft is definitely, from a filmmaker's perspective, the superior segment for sure. But because of what? Because of the camp and the audaciousness of the Thanks for the Ride Lady segment,
it's wild.
That is why I like it. Yeah.
Oh, it's good. No disrespect. I'm truly shocked by that answer and I really like it. It always kind of remind me a little bit of Large Marge from Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Totally.
Yeah, like scary lady hitchhiker movies, I could use more of them.
For sure.
And I don't know, the first segment with like the cigar store statue, I don't know.
Kind of boring. Yeah.
It's boring and like, is it racist or did you say it was woke? Can you give me a reminder of why that is?
My idea is just that it's like the whole theme of those, of both of those is like terrorize whitey, you know, which
it's a great subgenre.
But maybe I'm overlooking the fact that yes, there is intrinsically racist tropes at play here. In order for to work, you know.
I mean, it's not. I've never seen those tropes in action before, so you know, right. There's an argument to be made. I feel like a lot of people have one form of violence that they like cannot watch in movies. Like a friend of mine cannot watch eyeball stuff; it really freaks her out. Uh-huh. For me. It's scalpings. I cannot.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And so every time I watch that, I'm like, there's a scalping in here somewhere and I'm always on edge. And can I tell you why I was traumatized by scalpings?
Absolutely.
It's because of the movie Nurse Betty with Renee Zellweger. Do you remember this movie?
I do remember. I remember the movie. I don't actually remember if I saw it or not.
In the middle of it, there's just like a super realistic scalping out of nowhere. And I was a child and I was like, this is not right for me. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's where that comes from. Do you have anything that like you just go green when it happens in movies?
Strangely enough, it's stuff with like fingernails. So ooh. Like if they're ever going to dig under people's fingernails or pull them off or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever watch Masters of Horror?
Mick
Garris. There was an Asian horror segment that did some horrifying fingernail torture, and I forget what it was called.
Oh, yeah. Imprint, and that's a thing in Asian horror, actually. The movie Audition does it, too. Yeah.
Oh, does it? Oh, yeah. I've never watched Audition, and I'm not sure I ever will.
It's really good, actually. Yeah.
I believe you. I just, I am a bit squeamish with the grotesque. Like, because I love horror, I will put up with it, but sometimes it's too much.
Yeah, that's it's funny. My partner, when we met, it was kind of like, I'm saying to him, like, do you like horror movies? And he says no. And I'm thinking, oh my God. Like, but I was very attracted to him and I enjoyed him so much. So I was like over time kind of, showing him different things. And he was like, oh, I love that, or I love The Others, or I love this, or and then he'd watch something that I loved and he'd be like, oh, that was great. So what I realized is what he doesn't like is torture, he won't watch a Saw. He won't watch probably like a Hostel necessarily.
Even grosser.
Yeah. But, so I realized like, oh yeah, that I can deal with, but you need to learn that when you say you don't like horror, you don't really mean it because you do like all these other movies,
Yeah, they don't know what they're talking about. They need education.
He's clueless.
They are. The boys, they don't know. every boyfriend I've ever had, I've had to give a horror education to, and it's part of the journey.
I think that if you asked him now, well, here's the other thing that he and I grew up so differently. He's actually from Turkey. When I met him, he had only been living in the United States for like a year and a half. English is his second language. He grew up with a totally different pop culture universe than I did. And so what's kind of been lovely is him showing me stuff and me learning and liking, music he grew up listening to now. And vice versa. And like, he loves Freddy Krueger now. So it was kind of a fun way to sort of court each other, And now if you asked him, do you like horror movies? I think he'd probably say yes. I mean, he works on my haunted attraction. Like, he's really into it,
You have to be exposed to it. Exactly. It's like gay people. Once you know one, you're less upset.
That's right. Horror fans need to come out of the closet.
Yes. And you have to expose them to the safe, nice horror. That's exactly. The gateway horror, one would say. Poltergeist is a good.
Well, even I am like not a fan. I don't need to see Martyrs again.
I was just going to say, French horror is a no-go.
I'm not really, it's not really my thing. And it seems like in our world, in our horror community, there is this sort of almost like people pat themselves on the back for liking these hardcore horror movies and
absolutely
almost look down on camp, you know, and it's like, fuck you, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
Evil Dead 2 is a masterpiece, you know?
Oh, absolutely. But you know what? And so is Evil Dead 1. And it 1 is a straightforward horror. Well, I mean, not really, but...
It is. It's much darker. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I always oscillate between which one I like more. And every year it's a new answer. The answer is never Army of Darkness, because that's just a Xena episode, which has its place in the world. But
it does. But, you know, I will say this. This is not a remake. It has nothing to do with anything other than it was a return to form. We can call it that. But I loved Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, my God. You know,
loved it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Drag Me to Hell, I don't think it gets love, but it could have more love. Just like Alison Lohman. Where are you, Alison Lohman? Are you okay? Like, can I help you? Like, do you need something? Like,
right, exactly.
I know. It's so good. And it was like a girlier or like more female focused Evil Dead sort of energy.
Yeah.
God, that's a perfect movie. That's a 5 out of 5, Drag Me to Hell. Where's the sequel, though?
Well, like Trick or Treat, right? It's kind of like, okay. I mean, Trick or Treat 2 at this point seems like when you really get into the cult following that Trick or Treat has, and I was in preparation for today's interview, I actually read some stuff about, you know, the merchandising and all of the sort of cult success that Trick or Treat has enjoyed. And it reminded me that years ago I went to... This is before Universal Horror Nights put in the Trick or Treat maze. Mm-hmm. I went to the Scare House in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And they had done a deal with Mike Dougherty.
Oh.
And they integrated Trick or Treat into the Scare House. And it was amazing, like the way they did it. It was so good. And you went through. And what was nice is, because the Scare House is an independent haunted attraction in Pennsylvania, and it's kind of hardcore and it's big and it's really well done. I mean, no slight to Universal, but if you've been to Universal Halloween Horror Nights, how should I put this? The mazes are you pretty predictable. Like it's kind of there's sort of a blueprint for the way to do them. And then that blueprint is kind of repeated, but you insert, you know, Michael Myers here or whoever, you know, like the scares kind of happen
prefab,
the same. I enjoy it, but you know, you I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying this because there are big Universal Horror Night fans out there, but like, you know what you're going to get, right? What I loved about the Scare House one was they really made it an immersive, unpredictable experience where you walk through the different worlds of Trick or Treat. You know,
the different segments. Ooh.
Yes, exactly. It was just great.
Oh my God, what was the scariest one?
Well, I think it was the kids on the bus because you had to walk.
Yes, yes.
You kind of walked down the bus, like you were in the bus. So the kids in the masks are like little mannequins, little dummies. But of course, you don't know which one is an actor.
Oh,
you know,
God,
so you're
nightmare.
Having to walk the length of the bus, you know, single file. And it's just terrifying because you know one of these kids is real. At least one of them is. Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah.
But I do kind of love it. When I was in high school, I mean, listen, you've done this a million times, but for 1 year I did work at a Screamers, which is sort of like it's like our version of that here.
And so you do have haunted attractions up in Canada.
Oh, absolutely we do. We have two major ones. One is like the big mainstream one, and one is like the more rickety crickety, but everyone's really passionate about it one.
Right.
And that's the one I was working at.
Oh,
and
that's the one I probably like the most.
Oh, and, it's called Screamers.
Love it.
And I was in the play. And so what happened is they would like be doing this like torture scene on stage and they'd be like, we need an audience member, you. And they'd like pick me.
Uh-huh.
And then they'd like put me in like this thing. And the gist was they'd like stab me through the neck and I had a blood packet ready in my mouth and it would go everywhere. And then they would like tie me up and throw me backstage. And girls dressed up as like vampires would untie me and we'd have a cigarette. It was really beautiful.
That's great. So you
11.
Were a ringer.
Is that what that is?
Yeah. Yeah, you're a ringer, a dead ringer.
Oh, I like that. Very Cronenbergian.
Yeah.
Cute. Yeah. Well, you were saying how Trick or Treat does still, to this day, have merchandising and recently had like officially sponsored like scare mazes. So the franchise itself is sort of still in existence. It's still out there.
Yeah, definitely. I think amongst genre fans, like I was down in LA doing something last week, maybe, and I went to Burbank to, you know, do some of the shopping on Magnolia. That's like the gothic horror boulevard in Burbank. And I went into Halloween Town, and they had multiple trick or treat t-shirts for sale.
Cool.
You know, and it makes me realize, like, in the genre world, trick or treat is definitely still. It was that good, right? Like, even without a theatrical, it was that good that it could, you know, sort of make a dent in our world. And I think if they did a sequel, it could be a smash hit, you know? And I also think if they did a sequel, they could release it nationally, theatrically at Halloween, you know, get all the attention it deserves. Like, it should have first time. And they'd be giving themselves a push because they'd be reinvigorating a franchise, meaning people who hadn't seen the first one would go back and watch the first one. It delivers. Mm-hmm. We know it delivers. Mike Dougherty's a really talented filmmaker.
He
wants to make the sequel. He has ideas for the sequel. You know, it's a shame. I think, you know, when I looked at your list of, you know, sort of options for the show, and I saw that Trick or Treat was, you know, in development hell, I was like, yeah, that is the one that I would just be so psyched to see. And I liked Krampus. You know, I think
I did too.
You know, Krampus was a really, it was kind of like, it wasn't a sequel to Trick or Treat, but we did get another seasonal genre film from the filmmaker. And I thought it delivered. I thought he did a great job. But because it was a Christmas themed movie, I wasn't maybe as excited as I would be for Trick or Treat 2.
Of course, because who cares? Christmas. No one cares, right?
And we've seen, historically, ironically, I think there's more Christmas horror themed movies than there are Halloween horror themed movies.
There's no, and also, why are there no Halloween albums? Everyone has a Christmas album.
Right.
Where's the Halloween music?
I mean, I think maybe, you know, Elvira might have put one out a while back.
I mean, I would be shocked if she didn't. Or like Sharon Needles, maybe, but other than those
probably,
two.
Probably, yeah.
Do you have any albums otherwise?
I mean, not that are specifically Halloween. I'm certainly not a singer, so anything I've put out musically has been more as a joke.
I like it. I mean, there's a whole Grammy award.
Comedy. That's right. Honey. So we'll see. I think another interesting thing in thinking about your show is it's reminded me of what a disastrous bomb Hocus Pocus was for Disney, but that it took the cult, the fans, to over many, many, many years prove to Disney that this was a valued property. And so they dug it out literally from the vaults and started putting the witches in there. I mean, they were doing Halloween nights at the theme parks and not including the fucking Sanderson sisters.
The audacity. You know,
they have a Halloween movie about witches, and they were ashamed of it because it was a box office bomb. It was the cult fans who watched Hocus Pocus growing up as kids, who then said, no, we fucking love the Sanderson sisters. We demand them. And drag queens such as myself started doing drag shows, drag parody shows. And of course, Disney's full of homosexual infidels. And they, you know, said to their Disney masters, we'd be stupid not to exploit this popularity. And now they have an official new sequel starring the divas coming out. So
Disney Plus.
There you go.
It keeps giving Disney Plus, and I appreciate it.
So the fans can make a difference, right? So it's like, okay, Trick or Treat fans, let's demand it. I do think that if you scream loud enough, that
they'll hear you.
It can happen.
I agree with that totally. Also, now with streaming, like, direct to DVD used to be such like a dirty thing, but going to streaming these days, especially post COVID, it's not necessarily so looked down upon, because I think that's how Hocus Pocus 2 is going
to
happen.
It is. So, and I have to tell you, I'm very, very excited, because finally, this fall, All About Evil, my film's going to be streaming and re-released, and they're doing a big push for it. And
I'm like,
oh my God, it's like I get to, you know, a whole new generation of people get to see my movie. So
where's the sequel though?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I do have a few projects in the works, none of which are a direct sequel. Mm. Because as much as I would love to bring Natasha Lyonne's character back to life,
It might be difficult.
It's not the universe I created. Yeah. But that actually would be really, I mean, I'll say this. If Natasha said I'll do it, then I would find a way to write that script.
Well, she's right here and she's looking at me and giving me the cue to say no. So I have to.
Okay. All right. No can do, Natasha. All right.
She's thinking.
Okay.
I'm obsessed with all this. Well, my final questions you kind of answered, but let's hone in. Will this get made? Are we going to see? Because also, you and I have the power to actually make this happen or not happen. So Will it get made? I'm asking you. What's your answer?
Oh my gosh. It's such a great question because I think that the answer, my gut response is no, because if it was going to happen, it would have already happened. But then I keep, so again, in prepping for your interview today, I've been doing more reading, and I was reading interviews with the Mike Doherty, and he wants this to happen really badly, I think he has that level of talent where, much like Sam Raimi was able to go off and do the Spider-Man movies and then say, okay, now I'm going to do Drag Me to Hell or the Wachowski siblings, similarly, were able to do The Matrix and then do, whatever, Bound or, Sense8 or something they really wanted to do.
I think
Mike Doherty could actually be the one who gets to a place where he has enough power to just basically tell them what he's going to do.
Well, he's top of the world, Mr. Godzilla man.
Exactly.
I mean, if anyone has clout, it's him. But you know what? Even them, even those number one big shots can't always get shit like this made.
That's true.
It's a wild world out there. Okay, what was your answer? You have to have a yes or a no. Was that a yes?
Yes. It's a yes. I believe Mike Doherty's going to make it happen.
Hell yes. I'd even if he wants to produce it and give it to, me, that's fine. I'll do it. So
exactly.
I love it. Okay, so do you want to just tell us where we can find you online and sort of what you're up to these days if we want to follow and support?
Sure. So, I have a podcast coming out called Midnight Mass, and you can go and subscribe to it now. There's a little teaser up, and it's hosted wherever you listen to your podcasts. It's Midnight Mass with Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. And the first episode actually comes out next week. So excited for that. And then my haunted attraction, Terror Vault in San Francisco, has a new show coming out this fall called The Immortal Reckoning. And you can check that out at terrorvault.com. And then for all the Peaches silliness and drag shows and whatever else I have coming up, I would say follow me on social media where I'm verified. So, look for
She's
those
got
little
that
blue
check mark.
Yeah.
Well, rub it in. It's fine. One of these days. Yeah. I love it. Honest to God, thank you so much for coming on to my cute little show.
Thanks
it was
for having
very
me. You're hilarious. I really, really enjoyed it. I'm going to become a subscriber and listen to you. You're very witty, very funny. Yeah, I loved it.
It will pull through. Some of the episodes are good. What can I say? What are you going to do? We recently did one on Guillermo del Toro's Haunted Mansion.
Wow. Yeah. I will definitely check that out. Yeah.
Please, 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 please. We need every listen that we can.
Okay. Well,
up.
I have a question about that. At the end of the episode, did you say it was going to happen or it's
well,
not?
Well, it's a unique situation with the Haunted Mansion because it actually is getting made, but with new filmmakers, new filmmakers.
Yeah.
The director that did Dear White People and Bad Hair just got tapped by Disney to do it. So it's like a completely...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But it's not Del Toro, which is like, tragedy. But it's a totally... If they're not going to do Del Toro, then I appreciate them going completely different with a direction
yes,
I have
I
no
like
idea
it.
What it's going to look
well,
like.
Well, I very much liked Bad Hair, so,
I haven't seen it, but Michael Myers is in it, so
fun.
I have to watch it.
You got to see it, yeah.
I cannot wait. Also, there's the Muppets Haunted Mansion coming out on Disney+.
Oh, that's great too. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah.
So there's my answers for you. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back with another episode of Development Hell. Coming soon to Dread, The Maid.
Joy is the new maid of a royal house, whose previous maid disappeared under mysterious circumstances and is now haunting and terrorizing the family. Joy works to uncover the reason behind the former maid's disappearance. The maid will be made available on demand everywhere July 20, 2021, and on Blu-ray August 17th, 2021.